motion prevails and the minutes are adopted, approved. First item on the agenda is Senator Marty's bill, Senate file number 17. Welcome to the committee, Senator Marty.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Senate file 17 is simple legislation. It's legislation petitioning Congress to propose a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United ruling and several other Supreme Court campaign finance rulings, clarifying that our constitutional rights are for natural persons, not, in other words, corporations are not people and money is not speech, are the two main points that we would be asking Congress to propose a constitutional amendment to do. And the substance of the amendment would be that rights protected under the Constitution are for people, not corporations, limited liability companies, labor unions, anything like that. Human-created entities deserve rights and they have responsibilities, but those rights and responsibilities are what we as a society give them through law, through federal, state, local law, and they do not have constitutional rights. And number two, that federal, state, and local government shall regulate campaign contributions and expenditures of all sites, not just candidate expenditures, but independent expenditures, everything else, in a manner that ensures that all citizens have access to the political process, regardless of their income or money or wealth or whatever, and that no person gains as a result of their money substantially more access to the political process than others do. This is not your... We often pass resolutions at the legislature asking Congress to do something, and I think the joke is they get filed in the recycle bin in Washington. But this is not typical one in that way, in that this is also, this would be asking Congress to adopt amendments similar to this. And Representative Rick Nolan has introduced legislation, a proposed constitutional amendment like this. And if 34 states were to pass something similar to this, which I don't want to have, and I frankly think people of neither party in Congress do, but we've heard from several members of Congress and hope to be getting some letters from them as well with the same point, and that is Congress is going to do nothing unless they're forced to act. And what we would be saying under this legislation is if 34 states would do this, Congress would have to propose such a constitutional amendment or turn it over to somebody else to do it, and since they don't want to turn it over to somebody else, it would happen on its own. This is something I did not realize how much support was building for this, but last year in the November election, there were something like 150-some cities around the country in the state of Montana, which put this kind of issue on the ballot. It's more advisory than anything else. It passed in every one of those 150-some situations overwhelmingly. Montana has a particular interest because they have had from the beginning of their statehood, they had huge silver mining interests that corruption was running rampant, and they had, they've been particularly angered by this. Their state Supreme Court reaffirmed their state law, recognizing that their recent decision 2 years ago was likely to be thrown overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court, which it was. But this is something, there's overwhelming public support. You ask people, do they think we should be treating corporations like people or not? I think there's overwhelming understanding of that. I could go into more detail. I have only one person I asked to come testify. His name is Robin Monahan, and I welcome him if you want his testimony now. Otherwise, I'm happy to stand for questions.
Thank you, Senator Marty. Mr. Monahan? Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Committee Chair Senator Sieben, and thank you, Senators of the Senate Elections Subcommittee. Good afternoon. My name is Robin Monahan. My testimony is on behalf of Senate File 17. I am speaking in concert with Move to Amend, which is a national coalition that is calling for a U.S. constitutional amendment that says that only natural persons have constitutional rights and that money is not speech. It's really about corporations are not people and money is not speech. I am a Minnesota volunteer for Move to Amend. I was born in Minnesota, graduated from Minnesota Public Schools. In 1964, I enlisted in the U.S. Navy, and I did serve in Vietnam as a Navy hospital corpsman with the 3rd Marine Division. In 1973, I graduated from St. Scholastica with a degree in nursing and worked as a nurse until 1998 when I retired. I am also a Minnesota small business owner that helped create a business 29 years ago. In January of 2010, I awoke from a comfortable retirement slumber when I heard the Supreme Court in their decision on Citizens United versus the Federal Elections Commission gave corporations the same constitutional rights as persons. And becoming enraged by this idea that corporations had constitutional rights in addition to all of their legislative rights, I became outraged. But not being familiar with what is done as a political activist, because I was politically inert for 67 years, I agreed with my brother that he and I would walk across the United States to raise people's awareness about the harm to democracy that the Citizens United decision does. And so from early May or mid-May until late October of 2010, my brother and I walked from the Pacific to the Atlantic and talked to thousands of people. We had wonderful conversations with thousands of people, and 99% agreed that democracy is worth working toward and that the Citizens United decision needs to be corrected. When I talked to thousands of people, it was across the entire political, economic, and social spectrum. I would also add that we did not talk to corporations. Corporations don't have conversations. Corporations are not people. Money is not speech. The language in Senate File 17 is to help move we the people back on the road toward democracy by reserving constitutional rights for natural persons. And by making elections fair, where a natural person's vote and voice is not made irrelevant by tons of money being put into the elections by anonymous donors. We the people want the influence of big money out of politics and to end corporate rule. Because Supreme Court decisions, we need a constitutional amendment. A constitutional amendment is an ambitious goal. Previous amendments that corrected Supreme Court decisions include the 13th and 14th Amendment that corrected the Dred Scott decision. The 19th Amendment, women's suffrage, corrected the Supreme Court decision of Minor versus Heppersett, a decision denying women the right to vote. Those were ambitious goals. And yet, when we look back on those historic amendments and see what looks obvious today, first, the necessity to correct social injustice, and second, the inevitability of the passage of those amendments on the road toward democracy. You and I took an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. Now you have an opportunity to be remembered in history for upholding and defending by correcting injustice with the promotion of this bill forward. Senate File 17 is a nonpartisan bill having broad popular support for getting money out of politics, ending corporate rule, and allowing we the people, all natural persons, to keep moving toward democracy. Please support Senate File 17 on its merits and encourage its passage through the Minnesota Senate. In summary, corporations are not people. Money is not speech.
Thank you, Mr. Monahan. Are there any questions for the witness?
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you. Mr. Monahan, as you declare you want corporate money out of politics, I noticed that you didn't make any mention of union donations, 527s that influence elections. And I'm wondering if this proposal affects that as well, or are you just focusing on corporate involvement?
Senator
yes.
Marty? Or
I'll let him answer, but it does cover everything.
What he said. Yes, it, I'm sorry. Thank you for the question, Senator. The intention is to get big money out of politics through legislation, not because money really is not speech.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
certainly any campaign relies on money to get a message out. So I would say it at best is it's an ingredient to getting your message out. And somewhere along the way, I think it has some connection with freedom of speech, or at least it enables freedom of speech. As I look at this, is there any other way to affect the Constitution other than a constitutional convention? I heard that states can ratify amendments to the Constitution, and why are you moving in this direction?
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, 2 points. One on the first one on the money being necessary to get out a message. I'm not going to argue you don't need money to have it do it. If I can just tell you what I think and you have a bullhorn, you're going to be heard more than me. If you have the TV airwaves and everything else, you can be heard much more than me. The point is, and the Supreme Court is exactly right when they say we've got to protect the First Amendment. They're exactly right about that. What they're wrong about in their interpretations of this is the fact that the more money you put into it doesn't mean, I mean, they use in the Buckley decision very articulate language about how the First Amendment is supposed to make sure we have the most widely diverse perspectives out there in the marketplace of ideas for people to consider. What's happened, however, is that the more money some group or individual or entity has to put into the political process, the fact we spent twice as much in this election than we did perhaps 4 years ago or so in an election isn't mean people heard twice as much. I'd argue they heard less because they got so sick of the stupid ads on TV that they turned off they shut down their ears. They weren't listening to it, and the person who has just the voice or the small voice or whatever doesn't have any. I mean, Mr. Monahan talked about, I think he used the word that his voice was being silenced or made irrelevant by big money. And I think that's the whole issue here. We need to have a system where your vote matters and his vote matters, and we all have a say in the political process. And some people are, just because of whatever else, can have a little more perhaps, but we can't have it where people can dump in 40-50 million of their own money or corporate money or labor money or whatever kind of money into the process, and they have so much more clout with it. That's on the money thing. In other words, yes, whether we do it through some way to make sure that small individual contributions or public financing or whatever makes a way to have it so everybody can get their voice out, and not some people don't have 1,000 times the voice of others. And in terms of your second part of your question, isn't there another way to amend the Constitution? Well, the way we want to amend the Constitution is the way it's happened the other times, and that is through Congress proposing an amendment and the states ratifying it. This approach, which this is explicitly saying after 34 states would do it, they'd still have 6 months to avoid the need for it by passing this on their own. There have been other times when people petition directly for a constitutional convention. It did have the same impact that we want in this. The best example I'll give, I think the only one that I know that got like 20-some states to act was the one on direct elections of U.S. senators. And Congress saw these states doing it, and they did act, and they proposed an amendment to it. That's what we want to have happen. And realistically, I don't know of anybody of either party in Washington that wants to have a constitutional convention. But you ask members of Congress, they'll admit there's no chance in the world this will happen unless they're pressured to do it. And just by saying, either you do it or you have to have somebody else do it for you, they will do it. But, no, I don't want to have a constitutional convention, and I think that the reality is by doing this, the same thing would happen as with happened in the direct election of senators case.
Mr. Monahan, you touched briefly on how you walked across America in support of this. Could you just give us some more description of that, how it what were some of the highlights that you encountered, whatever else is relevant?
Thank you, Senator Seidman. How much time do I have?
Well, you have a little bit of time right now.
Okay, I'll give you 3 minutes of my best stuff. It was a wonderful personal experience. This country is a beautiful country, and it looks a great deal different at 3 miles an hour than it does at 70. We averaged approximately 20 miles a day, but in reality, there were some days we didn't walk at all, taking time off to go to various rallies that had been arranged for us in such places as Sacramento, Denver, Kansas City, St. Louis, Cincinnati, Columbus, Chicago, Madison. We didn't walk to all of those places, but we took a car from our route, which was mostly along U.S. Highway 50. In the western U.S., U.S. Highway 50 is sometimes referred to as the loneliest highway in America, partly because in Nevada and Utah, it's sometimes 120 miles between road or between cities or villages even. What was personally significant, one, it allowed me to study this issue for a long time. I did a lot of reading. But also, the kindness of strangers was phenomenal. Two old guys walking across the country is we thought it was a compelling story. The large corporate controlled media don't want the people to know about our story or about this issue. So it was really talking to small groups of individuals and individuals. We did spend 21 nights in a tent. We spent 65 nights in the homes of strangers who invited us in. And the rest of the time we spent in air-conditioned motel rooms with free Wi-Fi so we could be connected along our route with our families. The biggest rally we had was in Washington, D.C. at the Lincoln Memorial. There were a few over 50 people that walked across the Arlington Memorial Bridge to the Lincoln Memorial. U.S. Highway 50, in fact, goes right adjacent to the Lincoln Memorial through Washington, D.C. on its way to Ocean City, Maryland, where we ended our walk.
Sounds very interesting. Thank you very much for your advocacy. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on Senate File 17? Please proceed, sir. If you'd like to, now's the time. Sir, sorry, you go up to the table there.
Thank you.
No problem. And, sir, if you could just state your name, please, at the beginning of your testimony.
Hi, my name is Don Savi. I'm part of a group called Wolfpack, which is also advocating for a constitutional amendment to address this problem of money in politics, which is pervasive in our country in a very dramatic fashion since the Citizens United court case. I just got off the phone with Rick Nolan earlier and come to find out there are over a dozen small groups that are involved with this across the country. I think 74% of Americans do find this to be a significant issue with our democracy. The reality at this point, which I confirmed in speaking with Congressman Nolan earlier, is that with our current conditions in our U.S. Congress, the odds of us addressing this issue via Congress today are not very good. There is, however, a large group of congressmen that, and women that support this issue. We would definitely like to see the state of Minnesota ratify or pass this resolution. We also have a lawyer who's been working on this, and we do have a resolution that is drafted up. I've been in contact with Senator Marty's office and with representatives in the House on this as well. It's an extremely important issue. Now, Senator Marty mentioned the 17th Amendment. Minnesota was one of the leaders in getting that to happen, and I think that we should be leaders again and do what we can to make sure that this is addressed and that it actually can happen. Our framers of the Constitution put it forth in, I think it's the Federalist Papers, that we do have this avenue by which to approach constitutional amendments. It hasn't been done very often before, but I think the situation is critical right now that we do act. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, sir. Is there anyone else in the audience who'd like to testify on Senate File 17? Seeing none, Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you. Madam Chair, I just had a question for Senator Marty. Senator Marty, in our current Constitution and the form it is, as it is currently written, would you agree that it does protect free speech in the form of political contributions as it's currently written?
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, I would agree that the U.S. Supreme Court believes that's the case, and they are the deciding entity in terms of interpretation. I think the nation's founders would be kind of horrified to see what's happened to our political process with the big money coming in, where people who can't even vote in elections and entities that can't even vote in elections can dump huge sums of money in that effectively determine the outcomes. And so I do not share the interpretation of the U.S. Supreme Court on this, and yet I recognize they are the ones who rule, which is why I would say the only way you can change it is to either get a new interpretation for the Supreme Court or to make sure clarify the Constitution on that.
Madam Chair, I'm just amazed because the main thing is that if I just have my one voice, it's one thing, but if you aggregate voices together, and then if you can buy newspaper ads, you can buy literature, you can have a little bit bigger voice. We have many, many organizations that are based upon small donors pooling together so that they can speak into the conversation of elections and issues. And so I know we're going to have another bill coming up here today. So I don't agree with that. I think being able to spend money and have it reflect your speech, there is a direct connection with that. But the issue seems to be here on the big money and some of those issues. But I think that the thought that speech is not being able to use money in your speech, I find that troublesome. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Eakin.
Madam Chair, thank you. And Senator Marty, I was just curious. I know you mentioned that Montana did have it on their ballot, a resolution of this nature, and I was wondering how many other states currently have legislation that's moving, or if you have any information on that.
Chair, Senator Eakin, I know we've heard from several other states, and I know the organization, the Move to Amend, has been pushing similar stuff. This language is slightly different than what they were pushing, but I think they are now, they like our language on it. I think it's going to be happening in a number of states. I don't know how powerful this is going to be, but I think Mr. Monahan, I don't know about, I don't want to guess his age, but he and his, I think, older brother are feeling when they hear a decision like this and thinking, you know, what's happening here? And I think it runs across party lines. People just upset about it because they recognize Wisconsin, those special elections 2 years ago, the recall ones. Each of them was a Democrat and a Republican candidate. They spent in those nine state Senate races like $40 million. Most of it wasn't the campaigns itself, and most of the money didn't come from people who could vote in those races. I would care to bet a good chunk of it came from outside the state, and I think that just angers people. And trying to have a fair system, I think this is the kind of thing that can catch on. Yeah, amending the U.S. Constitution, unlike our own, is a pretty tough road to hoe, but it's it happened in women's suffrage. It's happened in African-American suffrage. It's happened in many times where we've moved forward constitutionally. And I think this is one where it would bring it back to what the original intent was, where people are deciding based on the merits of the argument, and we've lost that. So I this is the only state I know where it's happening now, but I've talked to people in other states, and I know similar types of things have been at least introduced.
Thanks.
Senator Eakin, would you be comfortable moving Senate File 17?
Sure. I will move Senate File 17, and we're to be referred to the Rules Committee.
Senator Eakin moves that Senate File 17 be recommended to pass and referred to the full Committee on Rules and Administration. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion does pass, and the bill
division,
is...
Division, Madam Chair.
A division being called. All in favor of the motion, please raise your hand. Opposed? There being four ayes and... did you raise your hands there? Did you raise your hand? There being four ayes and two nays, the motion is passed, and Senate File 17 will be moved to the full Rules Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the subcommittee.
Thank you, Senator Marty. Next bill on the agenda is Senate File 661, Senator Rest. Senator Rest, as you recall, members of the public, and we did have an overview on Senate File 661. So, Senator Rest, welcome back, and thank you for your work on this bill.
Madam Chair, I wondered, was the bill officially laid on the table? Do I need to move to take it off the table?
Madam Chair, I think we just laid it, or I'm sorry, Senator Rest, I'm used to you being my chair. I believe we just laid the bill over, so we'll just take the bill back up now.
Well, then, Madam Chair, then Senate File 661, as amended by the A1 amendment, is before us. Since that time, Mr. Goldsmith from the Campaign Finance Board and I have talked extensively to any number of interests to provide additional clarity on the issues in the bill. I think we've been very responsive to those concerns, and to that end, I have the A5 amendment.
It's actually the A6 amendment.
A6 amendment. Madam Chair, the A6 amendment starts off making some, and I don't, Madam Chair, I really, since this does reflect work that we've done on the bill, I don't really consider it to be an author's amendment, even though I'm offering it. I'd like to present it first. So the first part of it are some technical changes. The second part of it adds some language with regard to ballot question political committees and what their permitted disbursements are. I think it's fairly straightforward. On the bottom of page one of the amendment, we make some changes throughout now. The dollar amounts, either of penalties or contributions or whatever, threshold amounts that make them more consistent with current law, and so that is addressed there. On if you look at page two of the amendment and go to page 16 of the delete all amendment, we address some of the issues with regard to electioneering communications. We had a lot of conversation with a number of groups about their concern that, first of all, that voters' guides, even if they would show, 100% of one political group voting one way and 100% of another political group voting another way, that that was not what was intended by this. So that voters' guides are permitted and do not have to be characterized that way as long as they meet the characterizations that are given then throughout page 2 of the amendment down to line 2.28. And when I finish describing it, if members have questions about it, Mr. Goldsmith can go into the changes that are here and the development of this particular discussion based on conversations he's had with interested parties to make sure that they stay within the law and yet are the proposed law and yet are free to act in a way that informs voters. On page 233, page 2, line 33, there was concern about if in the future we move the primary to June, that might be in conflict with the notion that you could have these particular communications done within a set period before an election. And so what is carved out here is to say even if it is 30 days within even if it's within 30 days of a primary, if that 30-day period includes 10 days following the end of the session, that you'd still be able to send these communications out. So we make an exception for that. At this particular time, with an August primary, that would not be an issue, but there's a lot of thought about moving to a June primary, and this would cover that so that you wouldn't be in any jeopardy sending out communications in that regard. There's more information about the adding a paragraph on page 17, adding an e-paragraph with regard to these electioneering communications that includes distributing the voter guide that it's limited to obtaining candidates' responses and that they do not consider communications that would result in the voter guide being an approved expenditure on behalf of a candidate. We needed to make sure that that was clear. And then on page 17 as well, when we're talking about to whom will these communications go, the requirement, we're adding the A there in the first paragraph at 17.5, that it has to be made to the relevant electorate, that is, two people who can actually vote in that particular election for one candidate or another. And then also then adding a paragraph B, that the communication consists of printed materials other than signs or billboards or whatever, be also targeted to a relevant electorate, and limited. It's an electioneering communication if it is delivered in the mail to someone who can vote in that election, or it is distributed distributed door-to-door, what most candidates would call a lit drop, or door knocking with a particular piece of literature. Some of the next parts of the amendment, there's a technical change with making, or a clarifying change, I could say, in page 3, line 11. And then the amounts that are there are bringing consistency to penalties that are currently imposed, and that excessively imposed on associations any more than they are imposed on candidates and political funds. So those are just being brought into being consistent. On line 317 of the amendment, if you look to page 20 of the delete all, the association that makes these communications has to have done so willfully. So there's a higher standard, not only that they sent them out, but that they, as I understand the word willfully in the legal term, is that they knew they were doing something that was against the law. Not just that they knew they were sending it out, but they knew it was against the law, and that would be a higher standard to have to prove in any kind of complaint. Then we also again had some of the making consistent the fines throughout. The effective dates are to have it effective not August 1st, but the day following enactment, so that we would the campaign finance board would could get right to work on implementing these new parts of chapter 10A and 210. And I will remind the members that this legislation has the support of the unanimous support of the Campaign Finance Board, which is a board made up of six people who have to be confirmed by both the House and the Senate. By the only ones that are confirmed by the House, and it's not a mere majority. They have to be confirmed by 60% of both bodies. That two of the members of the board have to be a former DFL legislator and a former Republican legislator. Two members of the board have to have a nonpartisan history, and two may be one Republican and one Democrat, but no party may have a more than three of one party, and they elect their own chair. So it's a, even though the appointments are made by the governor, they are a pretty independent bunch, and they have unanimously supported this approach in two areas, and that is setting up ballot question committees, dealing with electioneering communications, and I would call it modernizing the expenditure limits and the contribution limits for those that take public financing, and redefining the period of time in which those activities can go on from an annual approach to an election cycle approach. So for senators, there would be three election cycles, 2 4-year cycles and one 2-year cycle. For House members, it would still be 5 in a decade, 5 2-year election cycles. And for the constitutional officers, it would be, of course, a 4-year cycle, election cycle. So, Madam Chair, that is the A6 amendment, and I move the A6 amendment.
Senator Ress moves the A6 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The A6 amendment is adopted.
So, Madam Chair, Mr. Goldsmith and I stand ready to answer questions about the changes that we have made, and in particular the conversations that Mr. Goldsmith has had with interested parties, 501c3s, 501c4s, political parties, people who are elected to political office. It's run the gamut of our conversation, and we believe that this is a good some good policy changes moving forward.
Thank you. I know that Mr. Knapp has signed up to testify. Mr. Knapp, if you'd like to offer your testimony at this time. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Ress, members of the committee. My name is John Knapp. I'm with the Minneapolis law firm of Winthrop & Weinstein. And I represent the Coalition of Minnesota Businesses. The Coalition of Minnesota Businesses is a 501c4 corporation that whose members are 11 different business associations in Minnesota. And what the coalition primarily does is engage in lobbying or issue advocacy around public policy issues, taxes, education, a variety of issues. And what I wanted to do briefly for the committee is to highlight what I think is a disparate impact on corporations, whether they're for-profit, nonprofit, business corporations, or whatever, a disparate impact that this particular bill has on those corporations. And I wanted to particularly point to the definition of express advocacy in Section 5 of the bill, Article 1, and electioneering communications in Section 33, Article 1. The definition of express...
Excuse me, Madam Chair. Mr. Knapp, are you referring to the changes that we've made in the A6 amendment?
I'm referring to the... I don't think the D1 or the A6 amendment affects those particular provisions.
Okay.
On the DE amendment, the A1 amendment, Section 5 expressly advocating, it's a two-tier standard. The first clause, expressly advocating, means that a communication clearly identifies a candidate and uses words or phrases of express advocacy. Well, we know what that is, and that, in fact, is existing law. So using terms like elect, defeat, support, oppose, those are words of express advocacy, sometimes referred to as the magic words, and that's been the law in Minnesota since 1976 in the Buckley versus Vallejo case. The new standard that's being added begins on line 2.17, and it refers to a communication that is susceptible of no interpretation by a reasonable person other than as advocating the election or defeat of a candidate. So Clause 1 is a explicit substantive test. Clause 2 is a reasonable person test, and that is what gives us some concern. And the reason why corporations are affected differently is not contained in Chapter 10A, but is contained in Chapter 211B, Section 211B.15. And this is interesting discussion in light of the discussion on Senator Marty's resolution earlier about treating corporate speech and 527 speech and union speech and individual speech all the same. Well, for over 100 years, Minnesota has treated corporate political speech much differently than it's treated speech by these other types of entities. So Section 211B.15 makes it a crime, not a civil violation, but a crime, to, quote, promote or defeat the candidacy of an individual by a corporation spending money. So it's not just a simple crime, it's a serious crime. It's a felony for an individual to spend corporate money to promote or defeat the candidacy of an individual. And a corporation that spends that money under Section 211B.15 could be dissolved. It's really kind of the ultimate corporate death penalty. The state could actually dissolve that corporation. So in looking at the changes to Chapter 10A that are proposed in this bill, we have to not only look at the impact in 10A, but also the impact on 211B, because you're now defining as speech that promotes or defeats the candidacy of an individual under 211B, both the express advocacy speech that will now be covered by Chapter 10A and the electioneering communication speech that takes place in the period before a primary or a general election. So, Madam Chair, that's the essence of our concern. We've had communications with Mr. Goldsmith, and I think the way the bill has been put together has been very transparent and open, and we certainly appreciate that. But we do think that there are some fundamental impacts on corporations, both for-profit and nonprofit corporations, that the committee should take into consideration in looking at the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Knapp. Senator Rest.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just refer, and I think I mentioned it in the original presentation of the A1 amendment, that Section 5, to which he referred expressly, the definition of expressly advocating, is Justice Roberts' own words from Wisconsin versus a Right to Life group. So this comes from this definition, comes from the Supreme Court decision, I believe, almost word for word. So this is not anything that we are making up in order to have a harmful effect on corporations. We are using the language of the Supreme Court itself. And I find it amazing that we would challenge what has already been decided by the Supreme Court of the United States in terms of what the definition of expressly advocating means. But I also would defer to Mr. Goldsmith for further clarification between this section and the later section with regard to how activity by a corporation is to be treated under the statutes.
Go ahead. Mr. Goldsmith, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Gary Goldsmith. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. As Senator Rest said, I have had many conversations over the time between when this bill was last in this committee and today, and we actually made a lot of progress. The bill is better for those communications, although I'm sorry to say we haven't been able to include a complete resolution to everybody's problem. I'd like to speak about the corporate issue with regard to the criminal penalties under Section 211B. I did try to work on language that would resolve Mr. Knapp's concerns, but unfortunately, I didn't feel I could reach language that would solve Mr. Knapp's concerns without essentially opening up corporate contributions as being something legal but punishable by some sort of civil penalty. Perhaps that could be done, but I was not able to do it. What Mr. Knapp seems to be saying is that there are two scenarios that he's worried about or that corporations would be worried about. One is that they might be engaging or designing some sort of communication that somehow crosses into express advocacy. And that's really a fairly high threshold. It has to be subject to no reasonable interpretation other than that it advocates for a candidate's election. Secondly, it has to be coordinated with a candidate before it's going to be a contribution. So it seems to me that the idea that corporations are somehow accidentally going to stray into a communication that is both coordinated and so close to express advocacy that no one could ever tell the difference is not a real threat, at least in my experience. Similarly, with electioneering communications, coordination is not required, but there's a time period within which they are subject to disclosure, not prohibited. And it seems to me the corporate concern is that if they make an electioneering communications during that time period and somehow it was coordinated, again, it would be a contribution which would be prohibited. And the simplest solution to that is to avoid coordination with candidates during the 30 days before the general and 60 days before, or 60 days before the primary and 30 days before the general election. And in fact, that's essentially what the courts have said you can do. If those aren't real concerns, then it seems to me that the only other basis for being concerned would be that they don't like the disclosure. I would mention, too, that there are protections for corporations built into the bill as Senator Est has introduced. And that those are, first of all, that a prosecuting authority cannot prosecute a corporation for a 211B15 violation unless the board has first conducted a complete investigation and made a finding. So there aren't 67 county attorneys out there who can just on their own decide that they want to bring some prosecution. And that's at line 5.33 of the bill. There's a corresponding provision in Chapter 211B. And there are provisions that make those complaints, that require those complaints to be brought before the board. So we do have control over it. The criminal penalties in 211B, to my knowledge, have never been applied. There, I am aware of one corporate contribution matter that reached the Office of Administrative Hearings and a very small civil penalty was applied. It seems to me that while they need to be looked at and should be looked at, that they're not a serious threat to a corporation that's not actually making intentional direct contributions to candidates. And finally, on that topic, I would say that by giving jurisdiction over 211B15 to the board, you will now have an agency who can study that law, study what other states do, and make recommendations to this body and the other body in the legislature as to whether those provisions might be changed. They're old and they've never been looked at since they were enacted.
Madam Chair, could I respond?
Sure, certainly.
If I could just respond to Senator Rest's comments and to Mr. Goldsmith's, just a couple of things. First of all, Justice Roberts' statement in Citizens United, to which Senator Rest referred, was not the opinion of the whole court. That was Justice Roberts' own opinion of what the law should be. In terms of the impact on corporations, my concern is that corporations will just decide not to speak. They just will decide they're not going to risk either a felony conviction or being dissolved, and so they'll just stop speaking because of the dangers that are inherent in this expansive new law. So I understand what's being suggested. I'd also remind the committee that the broader express advocacy definition was actually proposed by the Campaign Finance Board administratively in the early 2000s. But in a 2008 enforcement action, the Campaign Finance Board recognized that this was a problematic approach, and they retreated from this broader definition of express advocacy. So they're now asking you to do legislatively what the board decided they did not want to do administratively.
Madam Chair,
Senator Rest.
Mr. Knapp, I indicated that this was Justice Roberts writing for the majority in Wisconsin versus Right to Life. It is not the Citizens United opinion. So I think it's not fair to characterize this as just simply Justice Roberts' individual thinking. He was writing for the majority of the court, and it comes from Wisconsin versus Right to Life case,
Mr.
not
Goldsmith.
Citizens United.
Madam Chair and members, actually, it's Wisconsin Right to Life versus FEC is the case. And Senator Rest is correct, though. It was the majority opinion. It's been adopted and followed by other opinions. I would also point out that many business organizations, including the one that Mr. Knapp represents, have political funds, make independent expenditures now, and they know about coordination and they know about avoidance of coordination. That's the key here, is the avoidance of coordination. Finally, I'd like to comment about the board's action. I still believed and believe now that the board would have the authority under administrative rulemaking to adopt this definition of a term that is not defined in Minnesota statutes. You won't find express advocacy defined anywhere in Chapter 10A or elsewhere. The board hasn't done that, first of all, because we defer to the legislature whenever we can, and we think this is an important issue that the legislature should take up. But it does leave a gap in our disclosure law that was taken advantage of in the last election, and if it remains, it will continue to be taken advantage of and expanded. And so the board believes that the legislature should take that up. In more recent writings of the board has specifically recognized that we don't apply this broader definition because we have not adopted it either by advisory opinion or administrative rule, not because we could not do so.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Goldsmith and Mr. Knapp, if I would direct your attention to page 2, line 14, that's the express advocacy issue that we are currently describing. Very succinctly, who or what entity would make the determination, and I'm going to characterize it as a subjective determination, that a candidate has used words or phrases of express advocacy, and who or what entity would make the subjective determination, then a communication when taken at a, as a whole was being made to defeat help a candidate. Who's going to make that determination under this bill?
Senator Rest.
Madam Chair, first of all, it's not a candidate who's making, that's doing express advocacy. It's express advocacy for a candidate. And Madam Chair and Senator Newman, right now, that is handled by someone bringing a complaint. So it could be a complaint brought before the courts.
Madam Chair.
A complaint brought to the board, and then the board, using this language, would make a determination.
Madam Chair, Senator Newman, if I could respond as well, that's correct.
Mr. Knapp.
That's correct, Senator Rest. But the county attorney, ultimately, regardless of what the board does, one of the 87 county attorneys can bring an action, a criminal action, under Section 211B.15. And I have defended a client who was alleged to have violated that 211B.15. It's actually, he was a former member of the Minnesota Senate.
Mr. Knapp, isn't it true that first, as was stated, that a prosecutor has to, can't bring an action without the campaign finance board first making a finding?
The finance board gets to make the finding first, but the county attorney still has the discretion after the board acts.
After that
but not
happens.
Before.
But,
Madam Chair.
Senator Newman.
I'll try and do this a different way. It is my belief and it's my understanding that under the terms of this bill, prior to a county attorney making any kind of a determination, the Campaign Finance Disclosure Board will be authorized to make a determination of what express advocacy is under the terms of this bill. And the board, the Campaign Finance Disclosure Board, is going to be the entity that is going to make a determination on the reasonable person standard that's being imposed. That's the point that I'm trying to make.
That is exactly correct. And the Campaign Finance Board makes all kinds of findings when a with regard to following the law as the based on complaints that are brought to it. And they would have no additional jurisdiction under to do anything further under this as well. You bring a complaint, they consider the evidence one way or the other, and they make a finding. And that happens all throughout the 10A. What has not been the case before is that the Campaign Finance Board did not have explicit jurisdiction under 210. And within this bill, those provisions in 210 are now brought into the jurisdiction of the Campaign Finance Board. But yes, indeed, a complaint is brought. If no complaint is brought, there's no finding. They operate on that on that set of operations. A complaint is brought. They make a determination whether it's expressed advocacy based on a reasonable person definition, and if they find that it is express advocacy, then a county attorney may or may not take it up, but it would have to come from a finding of the board.
Madam Chair.
Senator Newman.
I'm not aware that I had yielded the floor. As I was discussing the authority of the board to make the what I am characterizing subjective findings under this new definition. And in that, I do see danger where we are going to authorize the board to make that determination, whereas right now we have got the magic words standard that is in play, which leaves very little doubt in terms of what can be stated. In other words, it's an objective finding rather than a subjective finding. And with that, Madam Chair, I would offer the A8 amendment. And I would ask that this is going to appear as a delete all. And I'm going to ask Senate counsel to explain why it appears as a delete all, and then I will, I will address the purpose of the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and committee members. This was drafted as a delete all amendment, perhaps against Senator Newman's will, but to get the job done. The delete everything amends both the A6 amendment that we adopted earlier. It takes out a large majority of the A6 amendment, everything that references electioneering communications. And it also amends the A1 that was adopted when this bill was first heard. So putting all of that together, it worked best to put it in a delete everything. As Senator Newman will likely explain, it amends the definition of expressly advocating and removes all references to electioneering communication. Other than that, it's the same as everything we've adopted thus far.
Madam Chair.
Senator Newman.
Yeah, and when I saw the A8 amendment, it surprised me a little bit that I was looking at a delete all rather than just a straightforward amendment. But the purpose of the A8 amendment, in my mind, is a protection of free speech in that we are going to retain and codify in statute the magic words, and we are not going to allow a subjective standard, which is now being proposed by the board under Section 5 on page 2 of the A1 amendment as amended. So that is specifically what I am trying to accomplish with this amendment, and I do not believe the A8 amendment, the delete all amendment, changes anything other than that. And that's the reason why I had asked Senate counsel to address the issue.
Senator Rest.
Madam Chair, I would ask members to reject the amendment for the reasons actually that we've already gone into, and in terms of describing the Supreme Court decision and the jurisdiction of the Campaign Finance Board. When the Campaign Finance Board makes findings in anything, on anything, it has to give reasons. It can't just say, we don't like that, so it's we just have an emotional reaction to express advocacy, and therefore this either is or is not. So I would ask members to vote no.
Madam Chair, if I could have a roll call.
Senator Newman.
If I may have a roll call, Madam Chair.
Senator Newman requests a roll call. Roll call granted.
Could we have some, I think, Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Goldsmith.
Wants to.
Yes.
Madam Chair and members, I will say that this would give clear direction to the board, should this amendment pass, that the board will not in the future look at express advocacy other than as using the magic words. The problem with that is that already people have latched on to this concept and are doing lit pieces that look every single bit like a campaign piece. We saw one. I won't say it's widespread, but we saw one which compares the candidates, talks about the election, but doesn't say vote for or vote against. And this will certainly become the method that people use who want to avoid disclosure. Remember that this doesn't have anything to do with whether you can do it or can't do it, or whether you can, how much you can spend on it. There's no limit on spending, and there's no prohibition. Even a corporation can do this as long as it's not coordinated. Mr. Knapp's client and any other corporation can run virtually anything they want, subject to disclosure, as long as there's not coordination with the candidate. With respect to the board, we do have experience in this. I want to say, first of all, that the standard isn't as wide open as it sounds. First of all, the court has said you have to limit your review to essentially the piece of communication you're looking at. You don't look at what the intent of the speaker might be. You don't look at what the perception of the listener might be. You look at the four corners or the sound and video of the communication itself. About the only thing you can look at is whether it's in proximity to the election or not, and that benefits the speaker because if something is not in close proximity to an election, it very well might have some other reasonable purpose. Secondly, when we look at something like this, we're not looking at whether a reasonable person could think it is advocacy. We're looking at whether a reasonable person could think it's anything else but advocacy. And if the answer to that is yes, then the communicator wins. There's no disclosure. So it's only when looking at this from the eyes of a reasonable person, you can't find any other basis for why someone would want to do it, that it would be considered express advocacy. And subject to disclosure, not subject to any kind of prohibition or anything. The board actually had a matter during the 2012 ballot questions actually leading up to the, it was actually leading up to the 2010 election, I think. I'd have to check it. But where we looked at a similar situation, it was a communication that looked like it mentioned governor's candidates, it mentioned representative candidates, but mostly it talked about the legislature needing to pass a ballot question for a constitutional amendment on the definition of marriage. That was what it mostly was about. And we applied the same standard because the question was whether the communicator was a lobbyist principal. Was this lobbying? And we applied the same standard. We said only if it's subject to no other reasonable interpretation than lobbying would the communicator be a principal. And because it also involved elections, there was an election coming up, it certainly could have been intended to tilt voters' minds in the election. We said there is another reasonable interpretation, and therefore this is not going to be considered lobbying. So the tie or the close call always goes to the communicator, and it's only when a piece is so clear that no reasonable person should disagree that it would be considered express advocacy. If the problem is with 211B, that's subdivision 211B15, subdivision 6 and 7, which are the criminal penalties, then the problem ought to be addressed there, not by taking out an important definition that is needed in Chapter 10A to make sure that people are disclosing their spending to influence elections.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The language that is being proposed under Section 5 is not so much what I am disagreeing with or objecting to. What I am objecting to is the fact that the same entity that is going to receive the complaint, the same entity that is going to investigate the complaint, is going to be the same entity that determines whether or not a violation has occurred. And this is a recurring theme that I object to throughout all of the various state agencies. Too much power placed in the hands of too few. And so while I don't necessarily disagree with the reasonable person standard under subparagraph 2 or the fact that we could clearly identify communications that are of express advocacy, I think that that is something that would be subjectively determined, but not by the entity that is investigating and ultimately going to determine the penalty that is going to follow. That's my objection.
Mr. Goldsmith.
Senator, I did want to point out one other thing, that there is a safeguard. First of all, of course, this is how all of the investigations of the board are handled for lack of the money to fund multiple agencies or to fund a process whereby these matters would go before the OAH in every case. There simply is no budget to do that, either in our budget or the OAH's budget, which is, of course, self-funded through a revolving account. However, there is a protection built into Chapter 10A, and it's actually part of our administrative rules, that says anyone who is aggrieved with a decision by the board can, in fact, ask for a contested case hearing before the OAH. And under the current practice, because of the way the funding works, that would be at the board's expense, not at the person's expense. And we would then bring the matter before the OAH, who would make an independent recommendation as to whether the board's decision was correct or not. And then the matter would go back to the board. Finally, if the person isn't aggrieved at that stage, these matters are appealable. However, the person does have a second level of review without charge if they're aggrieved by a board decision. And actually, other than there's been one other case long ago, and there was recently a case in the question of a waiver of itemization in a ballot question situation where we went before the OAH. But typically, people who have received judgments by the board in findings have not taken them further. They've been satisfied with the board's approach to the matters.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I appreciate this language, but I tell you what, it's an attorney's dream. This is lawsuits after lawsuits. You look at the vagueness of these words and phrases, and when you look at a reasonable person, have any of you ever come into an unreasonable person? I certainly have. And woe to you if an unreasonable person is deciding the definition of all of this. So I have a lot of respect for the Campaign Finance Board and they're reasonable and all these things, but then you add all the others, susceptible of known interpretation, advocating definitionally external events such as proximity, but maybe not proximity, limited reference taken as a whole. And so all of that context and all those vagaries are of great concern, but most of all, it's dependent upon a reasonable person. And I certainly have been in situations where there has been unreasonable. And if you're in that, you have so much power here. Not only that, then when you get to the next section, you have to have another reasonable person. When you have a city or county attorney, when you've gone through the board's jurisdiction, this new language, criminal offense, so on and so forth. And then in the rest of the language, you also have the ability to go after other issues. So it's very expansive and very intertwined, not just in this one area, but multiples of them. And so I just have really great concerns about this. Madam Chair is also saying, are we finished with our testifiers? I just wanted to be sure that I didn't ask questions or
Kiffmeyer,
take up time.
There's an amendment before us, and it's a roll call has been requested. So when members are finished addressing the questions to the eight Senator Newman amendment, then we'll take the roll on that and then proceed to the bill that's before us. Senator Cohen.
This is just an aside, but I really resent Senator Kiffmeyer's comments about the dreams of attorneys. And I think Senator Newman might share that. I don't comment about your aspirations and dreams, and if you don't comment on mine.
Okay, thanks.
Madam Chair, I'm very sorry I've offended the attorneys here.
No apology needed, Senator Kiffmeyer, trust me.
She was so emphatic about it.
Senator Newman moves the A8
they
amendment.
They told me so anyway.
And the clerk, and a roll call has been requested. The chair votes no.
Senator Cohen?
No.
Senator Eakin?
No.
Senator Hayden? Senator Hoffman? Senator Kiffmeyer?
Yes.
Senator Limmer?
Yep.
Senator Newman?
Yes.
Senator Rest?
No.
There being three ayes and four nays, the A8 amendment is not adopted. Are there other amendments or other discussions to Senator Rest's bill in the committee? At this time, is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify on Senate File 661 as amended? Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Hilberger. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Minnesota Family Council, a 501c4 issue advocacy organization, and Minnesota Family Institute, a 501c3 educational organization. The Amendment A6 goes a long way to addressing concerns that we've had and that we've expressed both to this committee and individually to Mr. Goldsmith over the last week or so, especially with as it would relate to 501c3 nonpartisan voter education, the voter guide section. And however, there, although it addresses that concern fairly well, it still leaves for us, we still have two grave concerns about this. The changes that were made to reflect and to allow for an exception for 501c3 nonpartisan voter guides still creates a problem for 501c4 voter education efforts. Voter education that doesn't cover as wide a range of issues because it focuses perhaps on a smaller set of issues that are of concern to an organization and its constituents. For example, with Minnesota Family Council, pro-family issues. And furthermore, a guide that does not have the same kind of neutrality in the way candidate positions are presented as would a 501c3 nonpartisan guide, provides a unique perspective on candidates' positions. So, for example, rather than simply indicating whether a candidate's position is yes or no or supports or opposes on a specific question, it identifies a position as being, in our case, a pro-family position or not. And in this way, assists the voters in determining what candidates are most closely aligned with their interests and concerns and which aren't. Does not advocate for the election or defeat of any candidate. It simply presents the candidates' positions, views, voting record from the perspective of the 501c4 issue advocacy organization engaged in that communication. And the language that's before us that would categorize such communication as one day not being express advocacy and the next day, because it's within 30 days of a primary election or 60 days of a general election, all of a sudden what was educational is now express advocacy. This is enormously chilling to 501c4 organizations like Minnesota Family Council and others that are engaged on a wide range across the board from left to right in providing nonpartisan voter education, not zeroing in on any one party or another, not making an issue of party affiliation for candidates, but zeroing in on where candidates stand on positions or on issues regardless of their party. Nonpartisan voter education. So that's one of the very serious concerns that we still have with the A6 amendment. The other very major concern relates to Section 4 and Section 49 that deal with ballot question activity and with independent expenditures and the required disclosure under certain circumstances of donors who make undesignated contributions to the general fund of an association that subsequently uses its general funds to engage in either independent expenditures or ballot question activities. We have no problem with disclosure of the association as a contributor to a ballot question effort or to on independent expenditure activities. But the forced disclosure of underlying sources, that is, of individuals who have made an undesignated contribution to the general fund of an organization like ours, as having been made to the ballot question or to the independent expenditure, political expenditure, is making a false statement about the donor that exposes that donor to threats, intimidation, harassment, and even actual harm, not only for themselves, but for families, businesses, employees. And we've got ample history, even from our own experience and that of our supporters, to bear that out. This is wrong, and it's unconstitutional. It throttles speech. I can't think of anything that is more intimidating to free speech than for a donor to think that if they make even an undesignated contribution to an organization that might be used for something that would have to be disclosed that they did not intend, why are they going to give? Why are they going to support or engage in any way in that kind of an activity? So these two provisions are in our view, are wrong, are dangerous, are unconstitutional, and they're certainly inviting legal challenges if enacted. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, sir. Senator, or I'm sorry, Mr. Goldsmith.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. The first of all, the electioneering communications provision doesn't, as I said, doesn't prohibit anything, and it doesn't limit anything. It only requires disclosure. And I might also add that if somebody doesn't know about it and forgets to disclose, the penalty is the same under the amendment. We've decreased the amounts of the penalties. So they're the same as the late filing of a campaign finance report. And only if you willfully refuse to disclose after we tell you that you need to is there going to be a significant penalty. So it's just like other reports that are already filed. The reason that the communication that Mr. Helmberger is talking about doesn't fall within the exemption for voter guides, he used the phrase himself, it does not have the same neutrality. And these are communications. They're not express advocacy, as he suggested. They would be electioneering communications. So they're only covered during the 30 days before the primary and 60 days before the general. And they don't have neutrality. They do identify which is, now I don't know about his guide, but many guides that I've seen, makes it clear which candidate the organization thinks is the better candidate for their purposes and which is the undesirable candidate. So they are things that both are intended to and will influence elections, and the courts have concluded that those are constitutional. In fact, Citizens United was the most recent case to uphold disclosure in those situations. With regard to litigation, it would actually probably surprise me if there isn't litigation that results from this, as there is from almost every attempt to strengthen disclosure laws. There will be litigation. But when it comes to disclosure, the states have been winning almost all of those cases, and Minnesota just won one with one very tiny exception in the last few months. So, secondly, with regard to underlying source disclosure, the people who donate money to a 501c4, actually, we enacted this independent expenditure law in 2010. You enacted it to give corporations a benefit that wasn't currently available. Here's what the statute said before, and in fact still says, and it's what unions do. A political fund is designated as the money collected or expended by an association that's not a political committee, so by a 501c4 corporation, for example. So its fund is its money collected or expended. Then we have 10A.12, subdivision 5, that talks about putting your money into or using your money in this political fund. And it says the association must disclose the name of any member whose dues, membership fees, and contributions deposited into the fund exceed $100 in a year. That was what we were faced with in 2010 when Citizens United was decided, and you enacted a system that makes those thresholds much higher. There's no disclosure of every donor over a certain level, and you never disclose more money than you actually use for those types of activities. And finally, although we've changed the method to require proration, which was optional in the previous law, and we've also increased the threshold for disclosure. So nobody that gives less than $5,000 will ever be disclosed. And if an association only uses 10% of its money for independent expenditures, no donor of less than $50,000 will ever be disclosed. So we have built-in protections, but to go much further than that would only foster that problem that the courts have recognized of large donors hiding behind corporations. And that's not to suggest that Mr. Helmberger's organization is guilty of that, but there are others out there that are. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who'd like to testify on Senate File 661 as amended? Thank you, Mr. Helmberger. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Susie Brown. I'm the Public Policy Director at the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. And just very briefly, since nonprofits have been raised several times, 501c3s, 501c4s, I'd like to just comment that our organization represents the vast majority of charitable institutions, which are 501c3 nonprofits. And Mr. Goldsmith has been very responsive to our thoughts and concerns about this, and we believe that the activities that are allowable under federal law and are not permissible as electioneering communications and activities will be protected in this particular bill, and we appreciate that he's worked with us to make this a bill that works for 501c3 nonprofits.
Thank you. Seeing no discussion, and or does anyone else wish to testify?
Madam Chair, Senator Rest
moves that Senate File 661, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the full Committee on Rules and Administration.
Madam Chair.
Senator Newman.
Just a couple comments, if I may, and a question, and perhaps Senator Cohen can answer this. It's going from here to rules, but there is $1 million appropriation I request in here. Is this bill going to finance?
Mr. Senator Newman, we are a subcommittee of the Rules Committee, so first it will go to committee. If it passes out of the Rules Committee.
Madam Chair, there's no appropriation in this bill.
If there would happen to be a fiscal note attached at some point, I would say then it will need to go to the finance division.
Madam Chair, the proposed route for this bill would be to the full Rules Committee and then to Judiciary and then a referral to finance to look at if there's any fiscal impact, but there's no particular appropriation that is connected at this point to this bill.
Madam Chair.
Senator Newman.
Perhaps I'm wrong, but maybe this is not the bill I'm thinking of, but I thought this is the bill that the Campaign Finance Board was asking for an additional $1 million in appropriation in order to carry out the proposed policy changes. Am I wrong on that?
Madam Chair,
Senator Rest.
The request for their budget is an issue that would be taken up by Senator Saxhog's finance division, and if they were to act on it, would be part of their omnibus State Department's finance bill. We usually do not put policy bills inside of an omnibus finance bill, but I'm assuming it'll have to go to finance just for the analysis of if there is any other fiscal impact that would be caused by this. But it does not have an appropriation in order to, quote, fund this bill. That's separate and would, as part of the governor's recommendation for their budget, that would be taken up by State Department's finance. So there's no appropriation in this bill.
Madam Chair, may I ask Senator Mr. Goldsmith a question?
Sure.
Mr. Goldsmith, is this the bill where you had indicated someplace that you wished for something around $1 million in appropriations if these policy changes were implemented? Am I on the right bill, Mr. Goldsmith?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Madam Chair, Senator Newman, well, you have the right amount correct, but your interpretation is incorrect, I'm sorry to say. The board's budget right now is $689,000 is our base. We're asking for $1 million base budget, not related to this bill in particular, but all of our operations. Much of that would go just to keep our funding and staff at the level it is. I will be doing a fiscal note on this bill, but the actual fiscal implications of this bill are fairly minuscule compared to the shortfall that we now have in our budget.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I stand corrected, and I've ultimately got my answer. If I may, Madam Chair, I would request a roll call vote.
Roll call is granted.
And if I may, then just a couple of comments on the bill.
Sure.
I assume that you want to move towards voting on this
yes.
at this point. I just want to make sort of some comments, and I'm sure Senator Rust will have some responses. And I would indicate that, first of all, what I have to say in no way is being directed at Mr. Goldschmidt in a personal or a professional manner as an individual. The comments that I have with respect to this bill deal directly with the Campaign Finance Disclosure Board, and I want the record to be very clear on that. I have, you know, I've read the bill, and when I look at what is being requested here, it seems to me that the board is asking for, I'll call it a significant increase in its jurisdiction. And when I say significant, I mean a great deal. Specifically, the board is asking for additional jurisdiction in a number of different areas and asking to increase the board's authority in a number of different areas. The board is asking specifically for the authority to make findings, conclusions of law, and orders rather than just concerning probable cause. The board is asking in a number of different areas to be allowed to impose separate civil penalties in addition to fines. There's one area in the bill, Madam Chair, on page 20, line 30, where the board is proposing to that they be given authority to impose a civil penalty of up to $10,000. And all I did, I wrote in my copy of the bill where I saw that was, wow, I mean, that is felony-level fines. There, if I recall correctly, there's another area in here where they're going to be given the authority, I think it was up to like $25,000 in fines and civil penalties. And while I think that there are some good policy changes in this bill, overall, when I look at it, what the board is asking for is the authority to investigate. Then they want the authority to determine whether or not violations have occurred. Then they want the authority to levy the fines and civil penalties. And then they want the authority to collect the money and dump it back into their coffers.
I apologize.
Let's let Senator Newman finish, please.
And when I look at that kind of authority, the good policy changes in my mind get lost in that additional jurisdiction and authority. And I will tell Mr. Goldschmidt and I will tell Senator Rest that if I saw more of this authority being transferred, not the investigation portion, but determination, the decision-making process, if I were to see that moved over to OAH like there is in 211B, I would be a whole lot more comfortable. But this scenario whereby the board is going to be given these what I really consider large jurisdictional increases really does trouble me. And the other thing that troubles me is this, and I want to try and phrase this as delicately as I can. What we have, senators, is a board that is coming before us and asking for jurisdiction to investigate us when when we do something wrong in terms of our campaigns. And I will tell you, I am very uncomfortable voting on a bill of this type where the very board that is going to make a determination of whether or not I have done something wrong is the board that is asking me to provide them with that authority. And I don't know if that's a technical conflict of interest or not, but again, if this decision-making authority didn't lie with the board but lied with, say, OEH, I'd feel a whole lot better. But how do I turn the board down in this request without running the risk of retaliation in the event I stub my toe at some time in the future? And I just feel for those two reasons, the amount of decision-making authority that we are proposing to give the board on these on this expanded jurisdiction, and the uncomfortable feeling that I have in refusing the board are the two reasons why I will not support this bill in its current form. I would like maybe that we could get into support some of these policy changes, but under these circumstances, for those two reasons, I cannot find myself supporting this bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rest.
Just, Senator, I respect Senator Newman's opinion, but two misstatements of facts that need to be corrected. One, any kind of fines that are collected go into the general fund. They do not go back to the Campaign Finance Board. And the fine that was that he referred to as $10,000 was removed by the A6 amendment. And although the board can initiate an investigation on its own authority, the vast majority of cases come before it only by complaint. And in addition, there are any number of ways if the, as Mr. Goldsmith indicated just a few moments ago, if a party feels aggrieved by a decision made by the Campaign Finance Board, they can take it to the OAH, and there are any number of avenues for appeal. It's my opinion, and it is my opinion, that the Campaign Finance Board acts to protect all candidates and all political activity. They do so in a bipartisan way. They're accountable to both the House and the Senate. And and I believe that it is we are moving forward to protecting the voters in this bill, as well as all candidates. So I respect Senator Newman's discussion, but on those two points at least, it was a misstatement of fact and should be corrected for the record.
Madam Chair,
Senator
that point, Senator Rest is correct, and I was inarticulate when I was referring to the money being deposited back in the board, and now I understand why I got such a reaction out of Mr. Goldsmith. What I was referring to is the jurisdiction in the bill that authorizes the board to initiate collection practices, and the costs incurred in the collection practices, I believe, then would be deposited back into the board's fund. Now, if I'm incorrect on that, I'll stand corrected, but I think that's what's going to happen. And what I want the members to understand that in normal collection practices, costs and disbursements are normally not determined by the person who brings or the entity that brings the action, but it's rather the costs and disbursements to be awarded are determined by a separate entity. And in this case, this bill will allow the board to determine what costs and disbursements there are to be ineffectively reimbursing itself. That's what I was trying to get at.
Madam Chair, again, that's a misstatement of the law. And the fines that are imposed do not in any way go back into the budget of the Campaign Finance board, and Mr. Goldsmith can give you more detail on it, but it just doesn't happen. And if the OAH, for example, files, if there is a an appeal made to them and the OAH finds against the board, then that they do so at the board's cost. The board has to pay for that finding. So I think it's just a misstatement that the board has a an authority to build its budget by finding, by having fines. But I will defer to Mr. Goldsmith for further correction of that misstatement.
Madam Chair, to that point.
Well, let's let Mr. Goldsmith respond.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members. I have to assume that Senator Newman is referring to text beginning at line 4.17. And this, let me, give me one moment here. This relates to a very specific situation that happens once every year or two, and that is where a, typically it will be a candidate, but sometimes it will be a treasurer, either embezzles money or comes up with unaccounted for money in a campaign committee. And at present, the board can make a finding that the report was wrong, but it can't do anything further, and it can't help recover the money, whether it was through no fault of the committee or whether it was the treasurer, candidate serving as his or her own treasurer. This would give the board the authority to start a legal action to recover that misused money. And the way the proceeds would be handled is, if we have costs and disbursements, they would have to be awarded by the court, but we would be entitled to deposition costs and filing fees and so on. The Attorney General's office would be reimbursed for its costs, and then the rest of the money would go back to the committee if it wasn't the candidate's own committee and the candidate wasn't the guilty party. If the candidate was the guilty party, the money would go to the general account of the state elections campaign fund and be part of the public subsidy program. The board never recovers anything for its investigations other than in a legal action in court where we might recover costs of filing fees and service of process. But our investigations are funded out of our budget, and the amount of penalties and fines that we levy is unrelated to the time or complexity of the investigation.
Senator Newman.
Yeah. And Mr. Goldsmith, I appreciate and I thank you for that explanation. Specifically, what I was looking at and referring to was a beginning at line 4.31, which clearly indicates that the amount equal to the board's costs and disbursements would be referred or returned to the board's general operating account. And what I missed there was the fact that this is a determination that would be made by the district court and not by the board. And I offer my apologies. I misread that.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Newman. I appreciate the clarification.
Is there any other discussion on Senate File 661 as amended? If seeing none, the clerk will take the roll and the chair votes aye.
Senator Cohen?
Yes.
Senator Eakin?
Yes.
Senator Hayden? Senator Hoffman? Senator Kiffmeyer?
No.
Senator Limmer?
No.
Senator Newman?
No.
Senator Rest?
Yes.
There being four ayes and three nays, the bill is, as amended, it's passed and referred to the Committee on Rules and Administration.
Madam Chair, I would just like to note that the witnesses that spoke did not sign the committee sign-in thing yet. They might want to come back and do that.
Thank you, Senator Rest. There being no further business before the committee today, the meeting is adjourned.
Are we meeting on Wednesday?